good, right?
Oh, yeah.
Welcome, yo! That's right. This is a Pregame Engineer Tailgate Mirror Racing Podcast, episode number 135. It's Tuesday, February 20th, 2018. I'm Tailgate Mayor Rusty Wallace, joining the PETM Podcast Studio with Pregame Engineer Andrew Sherwin. What's up, dude?
There's no editor to fix that, and that's awesome.
Nope, it's live every time, just like what we're about to do. Before we get started, the PETM Podcast is sponsored by you. That's right, go to patreon.com/PETM. And join the What You Drinking Club for as little as $1 a month. Get that free koozie. Best part is, every cent in 2017, we're donating to sponsoring drivers. So join that PT and Potsy today and be a part of the sport you love. This week's show is brought to you by our official sponsors at the $5 and up per month level. That is Catherine Kingston, Ashley Stang, Laura Henshaw, Harry Bolzania, Mick Rose, Aaron Bearden, Robert Keplinger, Tony Salt, Colby McClam, Eric Kepner, Ryan Kiefer, Marion Levesque, Patrick Cleary, Jeff Brown, Brandon Crow, Kathleen McDonald, Stacey Wright, Brandon Carl, Billy Workman, Rika Porter, and Jumpy Bob and Les Miller. That was a one-breather, dude.
You did pretty good on that one.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was just thinking, as that was going, how many of those tracks in that first line of Sidney Lett's song have we been to? Talladega to Daytona, Sonoma. Bristol, Charlotte, and Sonoma. Yeah. We got to get out to
Everyone
Sonoma then,
Sonoma.
Obviously. Yeah, yeah. So I was just thinking about it as I was singing it, and I didn't have time in my head to pay attention. So there it is. But we have a great guest tonight, dude. We want to welcome her on short notice. Thank you for joining us. But we're awarding two PETM PhDs in a row.
That's right.
I think three times on a show we'll get you that PETM PhD. And she's been working on it for like a year and a half. So one of our OG guests, welcome back to the show, NASCAR writer for Racer Mag and podcast host for the Racing Writers Podcast. It's Kelly Crandall. What's up, Kelly?
Hey, guys. I wasn't sure where you were going with that, but I'll take it.
Yeah, yeah. I think we introduced the master's program and the PhD afterwards. So, you know, you get like the not posthumous, that's the wrong word. What's the word for like retroactive credit? You know?
I think it's like
grandfathered into the...
What is it when they give somebody like a honorary? It's an honorary.
Honorary?
Yeah,
but, I mean,
honorary.
She earned it.
Lifetime.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
Something of that.
Exactly.
But no, not the one where I'm dead.
So I was like, posthumous, that's the wrong
Careful.
Word.
This is the one that actually knows words.
Yeah, right. We have a writer on the show.
Well, I know that one, at least.
Yeah, you can't call me anything that has to do with writing or talking, obviously, or anything, or vocabulary. Kelly, you know, we start this thing off the same way every time. What you drinking tonight?
Oh, just water. I'm being good.
Just water. That's all good.
Yeah.
That's our most popular drink on the show. Serena? Why did I say? I want to say Sherwin, and then I thought of my wife's name for some reason. Her name's Serena.
Oh.
It's going to be that kind of night, y'all.
That's a bad association.
That was a weird deal. I don't know what happened.
Wow, we're off to a good start,
it was like,
guys.
Sherwin, were you drinking? Sherwin, blah, 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 it all mixed up. Anyway, Sherwin, what are we drinking?
Well, I think you mixed me up a white label Beam and Coca-Cola,
mm-hmm.
which is excellent. And then, in honor of our race being in our state, in our city, in our metro area, I've got a Sweetwater IPA.
Right out of Atlanta, right here. And so you wrote a nice little blurb here for the What You Drinking section of the show. The Chicago Tribune had published an article very recently about a study done by a Cal Berkeley scientist. Now, I don't know. Was this like an undergrad trying to prove something? I don't know.
But, I think she was a PhD.
Okay. Well, maybe definitely an honorary PETM PhD for this study.
Right.
Said that nonagenarians, what is that, 90 years old?
90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, look at me with vocabulary. They're 7% less likely to die a premature death when drinking 1 to 2 servings of alcohol per day versus exercising 15 to 45 minutes per day. So how about
that? And that was a 1,700-person study. So however you figure that math.
There you go. So if I drink 7 drinks a day times multiply, I'm like,
by the way, that was Roger Diamond that turned me on to that.
Oh, nice work. Thanks, Roger. I guess we'll just mow on through our intro stuff, and then we'll get right into the juicy details. But it's episode number 135. I'll go through this one quick, dude. Car number 35.
Has anybody ever driven that car number?
The least popular car number in NASCAR history. So I figured we'd get here, but I thought it would be like by a slim margin. But no, Cole Whitt has the most starts in the 35 car NASCAR history. He has 36, so a whole season of racing.
A whopping one season of racing.
In the 35 will do that. Josh Wise with 35 races, so another whole season. Benny Parsons had 29 races, which was a whole season with six top fives. Cool Wiki, Darrell Waltrip, Lee Petty, Joe Weatherly. So some big names had like one-timers. Cale Yarborough, Bobby Isaac, Jack Ingram, and a ton of other one-race deals. But, yeah, nobody's ever won in it. There's been like maybe 15 top fives ever in this car. It was first driven by Glenn Dunaway in 1949, and its only success, I've already mentioned the names, Cole Wiki in 1986 with one top five, followed by Benny Parsons, BP, in 1987 and had six top fives. But otherwise, I mean, I didn't even really have a driver spotlight here, dude. There's nobody that like you hadn't heard of that raced more than like eight races in the car. So
bummer of a number.
Yeah, yeah. So car number 35. Screw it. Let's move.
Right, black on. Hole of numbers.
Right, right.
Very short segment there.
Yeah, Kelly, do you know any 35s? I couldn't think of any, and I should have thought of Cole Whitt.
Yeah, yeah. When you said Cole, that came back to me, and then I could be wrong, but I feel like wasn't Front Row using that number for like their third car when they would pull out on like the plate tracks for David Gilliland, or was that a different number? I feel like it was 30 something. I could be completely wrong though.
At some point when they fielded three cars, they would be number 34, 37, and 38.
Okay.
They just
skipped
over
the crap numbers. I knew it was 30 something.
37 went away really quickly.
Yeah.
And became another team, which now we know is JTG Doherty. But way before they decided to run two cars, there was somebody running the 37 independently. But I think you're right, though. I think they did have a hold of the 30. I think that was when Josh Wise drove it, actually.
Yeah, I feel it's okay. It's somewhere in there for some reason. I just couldn't remember if it was recent or not. But I knew they were using it.
Yeah, could be the deal. Well, with that, Kelly, tell us about what you're up to. How's it going? And tell us about that podcast. We want to hear something about that. That's new since last time we were talking in the pre-show. It's been like over a year since we've had you on the show, which is a little embarrassing at this point. I mean, you're one of the OGs, so it's good to have you back. And yeah, tell us about what's going on.
Yeah, just been busy. You know, I know we've talked about me being on the show quite a few times in the last year, but I think last year I was juggling quite a few jobs, and now I don't have to worry about that, which is, you know, you can take that with the good, with the bad. But, I'm just glad to be back. Got home from Daytona yesterday and tried to relax a little bit, clean a little bit, because, you know, Atlanta's going to be here before we know it. But I had this grand plan of just sleeping all day today, and I was so tired. And then I ended up, I don't know if you guys saw my Facebook, I ended up discovering Hobby Lobby for the first time, which people were laughing at me about. But yeah, not a whole lot going on though in general. Race season is here. It's time to get back in and settle down and pace yourself. So
will you drive to Atlanta or will you fly?
Yes, I will drive on Thursday. I normally, my boyfriend Chris is a photographer. So we get to travel, like all the races that I drive to, we get to travel together. So we'll leave probably Thursday afternoon after traffic dies down and just make our way down. We're in no rush. So yeah, we always get down there for Thursday night.
Well, we'll be going in opposite directions because I fly to Charlotte on Thursday afternoon. And I land back here in Atlanta at 6 p.m. on Friday.
Yeah, and I'll be picking him up from somewhere.
Yeah, whether it's, I'll either be Ubering to, or lifting to here or lifting I'll to my just, parents' house or however we do it.
Yeah, or I'll
my parents live in Fayetteville, which is only like 9 miles from the racetrack.
Oh, okay. So, why are you coming up here?
So the company I work for has a manufacturing facility in Mocksville. So I'm not sure if you're familiar where that is, but it's very close to where the Dillon boys grew up.
Yeah, I have a funny story about Moxville. I was traveling last year with Mr. Jerry Jordan. I don't know if you guys saw this little debacle on Twitter, but we were leaving from here in Charlotte, and I was traveling. We were going to go up to Dover. I think it was for the playoff race, or it might have been the first race, but we were going through Moxville, and Mr. Jordan got a speeding ticket for going, as he called it, extremely fast. he won't tell you the number, but it was quite something. So we always joke now whenever we hear about Moxville that he's quite familiar with that that fine established town.
With Johnny.
Well, Long hopefully Jerry will hear that I've also been ticketed in Moxville. When I used to live there for speeding on Main Street. Were y'all taking the 602, or what were y'all doing?
I honestly can't remember. I wasn't driving, so I wasn't paying attention. Normally, if I'm not driving, I'm just staring off into space or playing on my phone. But I can't remember where we were, but it was pretty early in the trip, too. I mean, we had honestly not, you know, gotten far, but they were hiding out and waiting, and they got Mr. Jordan, and his little Honda was cruising at a high rate of speed. So it was pretty funny.
And for all the listeners out there, let it be known, North Carolina is not a fun place to get a speeding ticket.
Oh, yeah? You got to go through an ordeal?
No. Well, so they have, subsidized is the wrong word, but that's the word I'm going to use. They have subsidized car insurance.
Okay.
For people who don't have traffic offenses.
Okay.
Once you get one, your insurance doubles.
Wow.
So Everybody hires a lawyer, and it gets their stuff knocked down to equipment failure. And I mean, it's not that expensive. I did it. I think it was $280, I think, to get my 21 over knocked down to excuse me, 16 over knocked down to a speedometer violation.
Wow.
But if I didn't do that, my insurance was going to go from like 360 to 740.
Wow.
Oh,
that's so nuts. North Carolina weird all the way around on laws.
It's very tough. Yeah, it's very tough, because I remember Jerry. I think he had to go through he went through the whole lawyer process to try and make sure it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
It's worth it because you don't get any recidivation after any normal period of time. Like, once you start having to pay that high number because you only paid your $100 ticket, like, you pay that double insurance for like 5 years.
For a long time.
You like start stacking those $100 bills up, and you go, all right, lawyer time.
Yeah. Kelly, tell us about the podcast. That's new since the last time we talked, and what you're doing with it and all that stuff.
Yeah, I had a bright idea one day. I said, hey, this would be something fun to do.
We've been there, actually.
Took us 5 months to realize that thought.
Yeah, you know, it was, and I've said this, I've told this story a few times, is honestly one of the coolest things about my job is when you walk out of an interview and you have such great audio because whoever you were talking to was just, you know, either so open or honest or just so genuine, and you can really, you know, feel their emotion. And a lot of times it's hard to sum that up in a print story. And so I had been floating the idea around in my head for quite a while of, I, you know, I wish I had a podcast, or I just wish I had some way to share some of the really good interviews, you know, share the audio of some of those interviews. So last year it happened so often where I just had the opportunity to do so many really cool one-on-one interviews that I finally got to the point where I was like, I need to start a podcast. But I didn't want to jump into it and not do it the right way. You know, hey, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not all the time, you know, A-plus quality or whatever, but I think the interviews are pretty good. I'm really proud of the ones that I've done so far, and, you know, for me, just sitting here, you know, pretty much learning how to do it myself. I mean, my boyfriend Chris showed me, you know, like once or twice, of, you know, how to edit it and, hey, do this, and, you know, of course, Jerry Jordan has helped, you know, he showed me how to kind of work with my audio levels and whatnot, but honestly, it's just me fooling around on the computer trying to do it, and once I nail down the interviews, it's like, okay, if I can just get this up into some kind of, you know, workable form where people can listen to it, then you know, hopefully they enjoy it. So you know, honestly, that's the backstory behind it. And I was telling you guys off air that I was so crazy, like so OCD about, you know, okay, I'm going to have a guest every week, and it's going to be a consistent project, and people are going to, you know when they can listen to it, and I was just going to be like so scheduled with it, and now it's just gotten to the point where it's like, okay, well, if they have to wait, then hopefully the wait will be worth it if I can, you know, focus on getting, you know, really good interviews and things of that nature. So I have a couple here hopefully lined up within the next, you know, week or so that'll come out, you know, down the road. I don't want to jinx it because I haven't actually done the interviews yet, but it's fun. And like I said, it's something different. It's something to, you know, keep myself out there, something new for me to learn and experience and hopefully help get better with interviews in general. So, you know, the feedback from everybody's been great. So I'm going to keep doing it, you know, even though I did give myself 1 star on my own podcast.
That's funny.
That's really
There's always got to be somebody, right? So just for everybody that's listening and for feedback for you, Kelly, the podcast that you did with Tony Gibson was absolutely dynamite.
Yeah, that was one of my. That's probably one of the top three that I think I've done so far. That one, Tony Old Man. I mean, Old Man. He's phenomenal. It it worked out so well in terms of the timing and how, you know, just nailing that whole thing down. And the funny part about that, kind of a behind the scenes thing, is when I went to record that with him, I went to Stuart Haas. It was the day that they had unveiled or officially announced Eric Almirola as the driver of the 10 car. And so I said, hey, you know, I'm going to be up here. You know, I had been talking to SHR about doing this with Tony Gibson, and they were all for it. It was just a matter of nailing it down. And I said, you know, hey, I'm going to be up there. Obviously, you guys are doing this thing. You know, is there any way I can come and sit with Tony? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. So I get up there, and they had allotted me like maybe 30, 45 minutes. And I was like, okay, that's great. Well, Tony had a serious interview right in the middle of when we started recording it. So I said, I'll just hit pause, you go do your serious interview, and then we'll jump back in. So it was kind of funny to start the interview with him. We're rolling through questions and then listen to him kind of talk, you know, even on some of the same topics with Sirius. I think he was doing trade and paint with, you know, Jim Noble and Chocolate Myers, and then jump back into our interview. So kind of just a funny behind the scenes thing, but you would never know it listening to the audio because it worked out perfectly.
No, it was great. I could listen to Tony talk for 10 hours probably.
Read the dictionary kind of thing.
Yeah, I probably could have went on. I mean, I was just scratching the surface.
Oh, yeah, right. You barely even found the tip of the iceberg with what he's got going on. I mean, I think I misspoke a couple of times talking about him on our podcast as I've gone back and listened to him. Like, he was a major part of that ColeWiki group.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
Before he ever went to, I think he had a stint with DEI and then obviously SHR and stuff. But his anthology is something that a book should be written about. I don't know if that's his thing or not, but somebody ought to write it because he's got enough stories for it.
It's like a Gordon Perkel kind of deal, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can just talk to him for 6 days and you ain't even scratched the surface of what's going on.
Absolutely. And the thing that you mentioned, ColeWiki, the reason that I really didn't go too much into that on my podcast is because Tony had just done Nate Ryan's podcast and it was phenomenal. So if you want to hear more about working with Alan and kind of how that whole team, you know, the dynamic, because Ray Evernham was also over there at that time.
Yep.
I highly recommend going and listening to Nate's episode that he did with Tony Gibson because he touched a lot on that. So that's why I didn't want to kind of bring up the same thing. But yeah, he was Tony Gibson worked with Alan ColeWiki. He's got some stories about that whole program. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure after I listened to yours, I actually tagged yours and said, and also there's this by Nate Ryan.
Yeah, Nate did a really good job.
And I think, in all honesty, I think what you're doing is really similar to what Nate's doing. And I don't mean similar like people shouldn't listen to both podcasts. I mean similar in that you're pulling content out of these people. You got your hooks in and they are opening up, you know, they're opening up their cupboards and letting information out. And that's so cool.
Well, that's, you know, again, going back to what I'd said earlier, I mean, that's exactly what the goal was. I mean, I do interviews every week at the racetrack. Some of them are for 5 minutes, just getting what I need to get. And then there's other times where I would sit there for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes because I want to do like a more in-depth feature story. And those are the times where, I was like, okay, this needs to be an audio form. So when I want to do these podcast interviews, it's not just these quick hits for something, again, that I could write. I want to be able to dig into some topics and get them to open up, because again, if you hear it from them, it's so much stronger sometimes than reading, you know, the print word. So I appreciate the compliment, because that's exactly, you know, what the point of the podcast was when I started it.
Fantastic.
Is now a good time for that question we talked about earlier?
Do it.
Yeah. So.
Oh, boy.
Kelly, what I wanted to ask you is, because of what we just talked about, in my head, when I was writing the notes out earlier in the day, I used the word expose, but that's not the right word. What you said is the right word, feature.
Mm.
You know, a sit down where you talk to a guy for an hour or a girl for 2 hours, whatever it is that you end up recording or writing down or however it works. In 2018, who's your lion? Who do you really want to get to do that feature? And why, I guess.
Well, I'll tell you guys something that I am working on, and I'm sure that as the year goes on, I'll come up with some other stuff. And there is one thing that I want to do that I don't want to mention yet, because I haven't had a chance to start putting feelers out there with drivers and whatnot. But one story that I am working on, and it's kind of been told a little bit before, but I'm hoping again to dig in a little bit more and maybe to a different side of it, is the relationship between and the bond between Rick Hendrick and Jeff Gordon is something that continues to fascinate me. And I know, you know, look, we all know, you know, Jeff drove for him for 20 something years and, you know, all their success. And, you know, we know how fond they talk about each other in terms of being, you know, close like family. But for me, I want to dig more into that. When did that bond start to turn from, you know, being more than just a driver owner relationship? You know, did, you know, I asked Rick, I actually got to talk to Rick last weekend in Daytona, and I'm going to talk to Jeff this weekend in Atlanta, but, you know, just dig more into that, you know, how did that happen over time type thing? And did Jeff ever envision being this close to Rick Hendrick and still being involved? I mean, you got to remember, he's still, you know, minority owner in Hendrick Motorsports. That, you know, obviously he roots for the 24 car and things like that, but he literally has a business stake in Hendrick Motorsports and the success of that company. So I'm just still fascinated by Rick and Jeff's relationship in general. So that is something that I am working on. But there's a few things that I have in mind, and again, I haven't had a chance yet to kind of plot out and put some feelers out there for drivers of stories that I want to do. But so that's the Rick Hendrick and Jeff Gordon one is right now at the top of my list. So hopefully that'll be out, you know, in the next couple weeks.
I think what I would add to that is, I think there's a lot of us that have been really paying attention to what Jeff's doing in his current professional life and the way Hendrick is posturing, that it seems pretty simple that the next, like, head of the kingdom or whatever king at Hendrick Motorsports is going to be Jeff Gordon.
Well, see, and that's a good question, because and I would think that way too. But I will say, as a, like, kind of a spoiler alert, I want you guys still to read the story, but when I asked, you know, Rick about that, you know, he won't for sure say yes, you know, Jeff's going to be the next, you know, he's going to be the next owner, he's going to be the next, you know, heir apparent or whatever it is. You know, Rick keeps it very political of, you know, Jeff can do anything that he wants to do type thing. But it'll be interesting to ask, you know, Jeff that this weekend and kind of see, where does he go with that? You know, does he want to be in that role? Does he want to be at the very, very, very top of Hendrick Motorsports? Or does he want to do it with somebody else? Or does he think that somebody like a Marshall Carlson, you know, or somebody like that is in line to do that? So I think you're right. I think there's many facets to this relationship, but that's probably a question that a lot of people, or a topic that a lot of people are thinking of is, okay, naturally Jeff Gordon is going to one day be the guy that, you know, runs Hendrick Motorsports. So, you know, yeah, that may be like a part in the story, but again, I'm fascinated by the fact that after 23 years, you know, these two are so close. It's like a, you know, as Rick said, sometimes, you know, he calls him a son, sometimes he wants to call him like a brother type thing. It's a really cool relationship. And again, it's one of those things where Jeff is heavily involved in the business aspect of Hendrick Motorsports as well, whether it's, you know, sponsor driven or working with William Byron or whatever it may be. So, yeah, that's pretty much at the top of the list for right now.
So I don't think it is avoiding the question if Rick Hendrick says that Jeff Gordon gets to do whatever Jeff Gordon wants to do. And so to your point, finding out and getting into Jeff Gordon's head, hey, what do you want to do or where do you want to be? Yeah, that would be really cool. And JoJo just said on the chat there, that would be a fascinating story about Hendrick.
That's the goal.
About that, yeah, and that relationship and how far that relationship goes to determine what Jeff Gordon does want to do, because he can do whatever he wants to do. So, yeah, really, that's awesome. That would be, that would be super cool, and I can't wait to see if and when that happens. We'll say when that happens.
Well,
yeah.
So
that one's definitely coming for sure. Fantastic. I don't know when yet. Like I said, I'm still putting it together. I'm going to talk to Jeff this weekend at Atlanta. Rick was really awesome with his time in Daytona after he did the manufacturer press conference. I think it was on Friday. So that one's coming for sure. But there are a few other ones, like I said, that I don't want to say just because I haven't had a chance yet to put some requests out there and see if anybody would be willing to talk about it. But I will say, if I can get the one that I've been thinking about since last year, I think that will be just as fascinating of a story. So, or at least, you know, I hope so. That's the goal.
Well, while you're there, put in a good word for the PETM podcast.
We're always trying to lobby on our behalf, of course.
Sharon, you had something?
Well, what I had was, I mean, they gave us a piece of data last year that suggested something's going to be different about what Jeff does, because he has not renewed his 2-year contract with Fox. To my knowledge, that has still not been renewed. And so that's why I was kind of half-cocked confident that, you know, Rick might actually retire. So we'll see how it goes, obviously. I love Jeff, like, in the booth. I'm not really trying to chase him out of there.
Yeah.
I think a lot, like him being in the Fox booth had a lot to do with Junior choosing NBC Sports. And also the fact that he's wanting to do more stuff, and NBC Sports was like, we're going to send you to Pyeongchang and everywhere else, Super Bowl.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever it is you want to do.
Perfect.
And as Elliot Sadler says, he went to career.
Let's do this, dude. For the first time in 2018, and for the first time in like 8 or 10 weeks, it's time to tear it down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I forgot all these sound things.
Yeah, the sound effects and everything, they're back. Let's do it. It's Daytona, baby. We went to Daytona in what I might describe as a... I don't know what you're
talking about. Whether or not we should tell this story, probably not tonight.
Okay. What I might describe as, for a person who really doesn't care for plate racing much, this was probably the most entertaining plate race that I've seen in a long time.
Well,
are you talking about the Xfinity race or the Cup race? Because
yes.
The word entertaining might be interchangeable there.
Yes is the answer to your question. I watched both of those. And I watched trucks, obviously, but yes is the answer. That was, so here's the crazy thing though with Xfinity is, it was so exciting. And then that last wreck happened before they started doing all the overtime. And I had people over at the house and we were fixing to go out to eat dinner. And like, I was stopping them from going out to eat dinner
for an hour.
And no, so we watched one overtime, and then it I was like, I'm sorry, y'all. It's getting late for what we said we'd go out. Let's just go out. I'll figure it out later. I'm telling you, we went out. We had a 20-minute wait at the restaurant. We farted around for 20 minutes. We sat down. We ordered drinks. We ordered appetizers. I pulled up on my phone, and it said, we're on for our fifth restart. That's how much time. So I'm not upset that I didn't see the end of it just because of all that. But everything leading up to that part was very
well. We had a tie,
Xfinity. Essentially, yeah. .000.
That story reminds me of like my experience during the ARCA race from the week before.
Oh, yeah.
Because I wasn't in Daytona. I was still home, And I was, my sister and I were going to take our younger sister and our brother out to the movies, and we were going to leave the house at 6:30. And when we left at 6:30 with that ARCA race, I think that, they were just going to the first overtime. Halfway through the movie, I'm sitting in the movie, it's now like 7:50. So it's been an hour and like 20 minutes, yep. Right? That race was still going on. I looked at Twitter and people were just blowing up Twitter about, you know, all the ARCA jokes you could possibly make. So I'm glad that, you know, you got to experience that with Xfinity because I did that with ARCA the week before.
Misery loves company.
Well, I had to eat a shoe because I said the weekend before that was an ARCA deal. And somebody else was like, no,
I think a lot of people said that.
It's a Daytona deal. And I'm like, no, it's an ARCA deal. And the reason why I started laughing when we started this segment is Rusty and I have this story about going to the Bud Shootout that we either will tell tonight or we'll tell some other time. But we experienced that ARCA thing.
Yes.
And it was an ARCA thing until it became an Xfinity thing.
Yeah. So biggest story coming out of Daytona. I mean,
ARCA gets a bad rap.
I love
them. Oh, they're great at the short tracks. They're fun at Pocono.
Yeah, that's a big track.
I mean, I like watching ARCA, honestly. For whatever it is, it doesn't matter to me what's happening. I mean, those people are trying to do way too much with way less of a machine than what a...
I enjoy ARCA. I'm just saying, I think, obviously, judging by, you know, the comments from that race and then what everybody was comparing it to with the Xfinity race, I just feel bad sometimes. They get such a bad ARCA. They get such a bad rep.
Well, you know what? We've had some great drivers come from that series, though. So obviously, they're doing something right.
I like this. Carl on the YouTube comments here says, ARCA... You know, they went a little crazy at the end, and then Xfinity said, hey, ARCA, hold my beer.
Hold my beer, right?
Watch this.
That's the new
thing. You know, and I said, I'm going to say the same thing for Xfinity that I said for ARCA, because it holds true for either one. And even for Cup, because, look, the Cup race had its fair share of big accidents as well. I don't know what it is about restrictor plate racing, but we get into these races, and all of a sudden it's like these guys just forget, like, what to do. Like, it just, yeah, I just sit there sometimes and shake my head. It's like, I don't understand how we get to that point where we just, like, there's like seven cars left. I just, it amazes me every time. But again, you know, that could be said for every race we had this weekend. So
easily.
So going to Cup, I mean, what's our biggest story there? It has to be Bubba, right? I mean, stole the show. And not, you know, intentionally or whatever. Oh, I meant to grab my Bubba hat before I got on. I'm cussing myself.
Eldora's a good hat.
I've got an Eldora hat on right now, so but I'm not upset about Eldora, but my Bubba hat with Bubba's signature on it and all that. Kelly, were you in the media center afterwards when all that went down? I say media center, in the whatever room they call that, to see all that go down?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was the media center, so... The end of the race obviously was crazy. You know, I go outside for the finish. A lot of us media, we go outside for the finish to try and get drivers on pit road afterwards. And, you know, the last lap happens and, you know, we're out on pit road. And at first, you know, we can't find, I think most of us at first were looking for Eric Almirola because, of course, you want to get, you know, his version of what happened on the last lap. So first we had to figure out, okay, Eric didn't drive his car back, so he's probably at the care center. And then it took all of us a few minutes to realize that something must have happened with Bubba because he didn't drive his car back to pit road either. And, of course, you know, we come to find out he and Denny had crashed past the start-finish line. So go to the care center, get Eric, and they say, you know, Bubba's going to go to the media center. He's not going to talk out here. Okay, so... Hike it back in the media center. They bring Denny Hamlin in. He does his thing. And then here comes Bubba. And, you know, Bubba's all excited. And you know, they're telling him about, you know, NASCAR's introducing him about, okay, you know, runner up. And, you know, the highest finishing African American since Wendell Scott. I think it was in the 1966 race. And
in the car number 34 that we talked about last week, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Wendell won in 34.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then all of a sudden, here comes his mom, and, you know, it's a sweet moment, and she's like, you know, I got lost outside. I guess she hadn't seen Bubba, and she wanted to give him a hug. But as soon as you know, she goes up on stage, and Bubba stands up from his chair, I mean, it was... It was hard for all of us to not get swept up in the emotion. I think everybody stopped what they were doing, whether they were writing or taking notes or whatever it was, and everybody turned and looked, because it got so quiet, and you can hear them sobbing into each other's shoulders. You can hear her tell him how proud she was and how long he had waited.
Loud and clear, yeah.
You know. And yeah, and you know, he's trying not to cry, but he's sobbing, and you know, trying to, you know, he's like, "Mom, you're acting like we won the race," and you know, so that brings a round of laughs. But it just kept going on and on. If you have, I think a few people have posted on Twitter. I think NASCAR even posted the full video from the press conference, maybe on YouTube somewhere. I know there's video out there. If you haven't seen it, it's probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen in a media center, because it was genuine and it was so real. And for Bubba to, I mean, he's already an emotional guy as it is, but for him to not even like try to hide the fact that, you know, he just finished second and how emotional he was for his family to be there, which he talked about. I mean, mm-hmm. for him to not care and just say, "I'm going to sob and I'm going to get it out." It was really, really cool.
That was.
I can tell you that when I watched it, I bawled my eyes out. That's just how I do. I'm the emotional
one
in this group.
I've honestly never, the more I think about it, like, I don't think I've ever seen a media center just come to a complete stop like that. And everybody's attention was on what was going on. And then everybody started grabbing their phones to capture the moment, because everybody, like, it was so special. And yeah. It's really cool that... that got to be shared with everybody who wasn't there, because again, it goes back to what I said earlier. It's so hard to try and sum that up into a print story, because it was so awesome.
Yeah. Whoever asked that first question too was there. Well, I was going to ask about, but just ask about something irrelevant, but tell me, you know, what's going on in your mind, right? And that let the floodgates open. That was a great, situational awareness by that person too. Do you know who was that asked that
so NASCAR, whoever was moderating from NASCAR, I think always kind of opens it up first and just says, you know, whoever it is, you finished second, tell us about your race type thing. So if that's what you're talking about, it was probably NASCAR moderator. And then I can't remember, I think Holly Kane might have had the first actual media question, okay. But I'm not sure on that.
So if you follow Bubba throughout the whole weekend, I mean, and even just race day, if you look at, you know, all these appearances and everything, race day comes along. He gets that tweet from Lewis Hamilton, and he's saying he's like fangirling out about it. He's like, oh my God, Lewis Hamilton has just tweeted at me. That's so cool. You know, obviously a mentor, not mentor, but maybe hero of his. And then getting a phone call from Hank Aaron from the same town he's from in Mobile, and then going on and doing all this, and then his mama and his sister and everybody coming up afterwards. I mean, holy mackerel. I don't know what to say. I mean, that is the storyline. I just got goosebumps. Look at that.
It is the storyline, and let me try to explain this too. So, and Dale Jr., for anybody who listens to Dale Jr.'s podcast, he touched on this as well in his episode today. And Dale can really speak to it, because he drew a great comparison of the media attention that he got when, you know, if anybody remembers back down the back in 99 or right before going into his rookie season in 2000, does anybody remember that big like countdown to E-Day thing that they did, where they were doing this whole, all this big media and press conferences to get to announce Junior and Budweiser for his rookie year? So Dale made a great comparison to that on his podcast, but me being in Daytona, I can tell you that Bubba Wallace was the guy in Daytona all week. I mean, I know Danica, it was Danica's last race, and she certainly got her fair share of attention. But when it comes to media, Bubba Wallace was the guy. You have to remember, he had Facebook and all those cameras following him, they've been following him for the past couple months. They were down there with him following his every move. He was doing, you know, so I think he did an appearance on, or maybe not an appearance, but somebody from the Howard Stern show was down there doing something with Bubba. He had a bunch of national media outlets. He shared a great picture on social media. If you go to his Twitter page, it's him sitting in a chair outside his motorhome, and he's just facing like a wall of reporters. And I mean, he did media center appearances, and you know, people in the garage who were coming up to him with video cameras or whatever it was. So the fact that Bubba not only performed during Speed Weeks, and remember, he performed well in his duel, and then obviously with everything that happened in the 500, but the way he handled himself all throughout Speed Weeks and had all of this media attention around him, that was absolutely the story. And kudos to him, because he, you know, look, I'm sure it's horrible, and I can't imagine having, you know, constant cameras around you 24/7, but he seemed to really do a wonderful job with everybody that came up to him with questions, every media outlet, you know, all those cameras. And so kudos to him for doing that, and for doing it well. So, but he was definitely, and no disrespect to Austin Dillon, but Bubba, in my opinion, was the story of Speed Weeks, and certainly the story after the Daytona 500.
Absolutely. Hell yeah. Well, Junior talked about on his podcast today that he did from the Atlanta airport with Mike Davis. He talked about that, how like he walked down to where Bubba's bus was, and he was holding court because he had to. Every time he went to his bus, every time he walked in or out of it, there was people there, and he was like very gracious with his time. He answered questions, he signed autographs, whatever it was.
And I'm sure it was tiring, but he did all of it.
He was all in, Bubba.
And Richard Petty Motorsports, they were on top of things when it came to, you know, highlighting it on their social media. So, and again, I recommend everybody go to Bubba's timeline and just scroll through his pictures, because, you know, the things that he did, and certainly that one picture where he's just facing a wall of media members, I think will really kind of sum up, you know, what his Speed Weeks was all about.
So a question from William Saquet, did we figure out?
Saquet.
Oh, geez. I was Samsonite.
I think we've decided that whether or not he's French Canadian.
William Saquet.
William Saquet.
He sent in a question that says, Bubba only has 18 races. So we'll give this some context in a moment. He only has 18 races, including this weekend, covered for sponsorship by his count. Are good finishes and personality enough to secure more sponsorship? Number one, I would say those are the two things that get you sponsorship, is great personality and good finishes. That's what it takes.
Well,
and number two, he sent this like 5 minutes before Bubba and his race and RPM announced that they had a sponsor, like a new sponsor for Atlanta and stuff. And so
Smithfield was, for six yeah. more. So he sent it with 12 in the title. He's like, so they only have 12 sponsored, just like Junior had said on his podcast. He's only got a third of his season sponsored. Well, no sooner did the William send us the question, did Smithfield sign up for six races? And what they said was they were going to be supportive of their distributors and their other brands.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to be a lot like what that Kroger sponsorship is on the 47 and the 37 and what the 42 Target sponsorship used to be.
And that's not a new sponsorship for RPM necessarily either.
There was a very
I have
contentious relationship last year.
True. But I think it was it last year or year before?
Oh, it was a handshake deal.
Something like that. I saw Richard Petty in person, and I was like, holy crap, this is so cool. I can't believe it's Richard Petty. And it was at a Smithfield tent. Like, he was there to do a thing.
So late last year's season is when that whole, we had a deal. No, we didn't have a deal. And they went to SHR, and they still hadn't announced Eric Almirola in the tent. So we were all speculating, is that sponsorship going to Clint? Since Clint was really uncovered at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you guys got your timeline right.
Yeah. So let's, that's a Bubba deal. Let's move on to Austin Dillon. winning this race, which it's crazy to think that Austin Dillon in the number three car at Daytona winning the race is kind of like the number two story. And not the number two story because of something bad, but because of something good, you know?
Right.
But let's start this off by like rewinding to Thursday of this last week when on this podcast, Sherwin rolled a die to determine who my pick was going to be. And I was just saying that I'm glad that you didn't pick Austin Dillon because I have no idea how I would.
Because I rolled a three on the die.
Yeah, you rolled a three on the die, but that was for third place, which was Kevin Harvick. But if I was going on like car numbers, that would have been Austin Dillon. So here's to remind y'all. I've got the clip right here, and I've chopped it up into certain pieces because thank you, Mr. Orange Cone. There's some not safe for life stuff in between.
Not safe for life is the right way to put it.
But here it goes. Here it is right here. I'm glad you didn't roll Austin Dillon. That would have been tough to justify. So,
oh, goodness.
I don't know. I was trying to figure out what I would have said about Austin Dillon. Well, it's all about being there at the end. And Austin Dillon, you know. So that was it. That was on Thursday's podcast. Was me saying, thank goodness, Sherwin, you didn't roll Austin Dillon. I don't know what I'd have said other than it's all about being there at the end. But, you know, I went back and looked. Like, he's had top tens in the last, like, 5 of 6 years or something. Like, he's there at the end. You know, what do you want me to say?
He does survive plate racing.
It's impressive.
When he doesn't hit the
not 5 out of 6
tower.
Years, 5 or 6 races, I
yeah,
should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this is his fourth year full-time in Cup, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 5 out of 6 races at Daytona, he's had top tens, is what I mean. Or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Kelly, what's your take on the Austin Dillon win? Is this like surprising? Is it, hey, Austin's there at the end, or you know, we were joking last time about how would I defend Austin Dillon as my random pick that Sherwin rolls on a die, and it happened to come true.
Well, I think it's surprising because he's only won one race before that, and that came on fuel mileage where you know he only led I think like one lap or two or whatever it was, so. It's surprising in that regard that, you know, now he's got two wins and they're two of the biggest wins in the sport. Not necessarily surprising that, you know, he was around at the end because, like you mentioned, I mean, he is a pretty decent plate racer. But again, you know, a lot of these guys' statistics can be skewed because it is plate racing. I mean, look at, you know, for the longest time, my example that I always would always use is look at Kurt Busch. Until Kurt Busch won the Daytona 500 last year, he didn't have a plate win. But for me, Kurt Busch is one of the best plate racers in the series. So, you know, statistics can be kind of skewed because, once again, either you get caught up in stuff or, you know, you just can't close it out. So I think for Austin, obviously, the race playing out the way it did where he missed, you know, a couple big wrecks, and then, of course, that last big wreck, the one that took out Blaney and Kurt Busch, Stenhouse, Bowman, you know, all those guys, you know, certainly put him in position, and him and Bubba. And I think having Bubba behind him was the difference because, you know, that's where that run came from going down the backstretch. So, yeah, I mean, again, you know, surprising that it was Austin Dillon, yes. I certainly didn't think, you know, Sunday night I was going to be writing about Austin Dillon winning the Daytona 500. So surprising in that regard, but I don't mean that, again, I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, just because, you know, I don't think many people would have put him on the short list.
Well, I think you made a great point about Kurt Busch, too. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, is that I believe he had 7 second place plate race finishes before he actually won the Daytona 500. Not necessarily 7 at Daytona in the 500, but overall between the 4 races, I think he had 7 seconds.
I remember last year at Daytona 500 Media Day talking to Kurt Busch about, you know, can this be the time, you know, you finally just break through for a plate win. You know, he's won Xfinity races at Daytona. He's won a qualifying, a dual qualifying race. But when it comes to a points-paying race at Daytona and Talladega, until last year, he hadn't done that. So it was kind of ironic to me that I had written that story going into the Daytona 500 last year, where he talked about, you know, like you mentioned, how close he had been. Remember, he dominated a few Daytona 500s and ended up wrecked. I mean, the one that immediately comes to mind, I want to say 2007, when he was driving for Penske, he and Tony Stewart dominated that race and crashed together coming off turn four because they were racing each other too hard. And they still had, you know, quite a ways to go in that race. So, yeah, I mean, Kurt is just one example of just how, you know, of going back to what I said, of statistics can be skewed, because he could be, you know, there's a lot of these guys. Brad Keselowski is another one. Obviously, he hasn't won the Daytona 500, but we consider him probably the best plate racer in the series right now, because he's got like 700 wins at Talladega, and he's won, you know, just about everything else at Daytona at this point. So, yeah, again, you know, no disrespect to Austin Dillon, but I don't think going into the weekend he was on a lot of people's short list.
I think one of the biggest surprises this weekend, and with the Daytona 500, is something that you kind of hinted at right there with Kurt Busch and Tony Stewart, which is the early aggression that was going on in this race. And the early everybody has said, you know, it should have been single file forever. I mean, Jimmy Johnson said it when he's like, this is like two laps to go in stage one. What are we doing right now?
Yeah, well, they crashed on the last lap of stage one.
Yeah,
so
yeah. And so is the answer. So one of the talking points, or I would say the big talking point for me before this race was the young guns versus the veterans and who's going to come out on top. Do you think this is a young guys really trying to strike type of thing versus veterans who just want to, they're like, hey, let's get in the single file. This is what we do at Daytona. And the young guys are like, I don't know, I got to get some points. Or was this a different factor, or was this like a stacking things on top of each other sort of deal?
I think, so me personally, I think it was a little bit of having to do with stages, the stage points.
Okay.
Now, granted, we have crashed at restrictor plate tracks for years. but I think at least this year, what we're probably going to see the rest of this year, what we saw Sunday, and certainly I think what we saw last year, is these guys are being just a little bit more aggressive because those points are on the line. Now, in general, I think the reason we had a Daytona 500 like we had is because you have guys like Chase Elliott, like Brad Keselowski, Ryan Blaney, Denny Hamlin. I mean, I can name probably quite a few who they are not going to ride around. I mean, it's just not going to happen. They want to go race. And I love that. And I understand Jimmy Johnson, certainly, and I understand everybody who's like, why aren't we logging laps and saving our cars? But, A, if they were to do that for 190 laps of 200, we all would be sitting here screaming at the top of our lungs about how boring a race that was. And two, I don't want to see that. I don't mind that these races are crash filled, and I know I'm probably going to upset a lot of people right now.
I don't mind that
these races are crash filled, because it goes to what I just said. I want to see these guys racing. I want to see them out there making these moves, trying to lead laps, because if they're out there doing that, they're entertaining me, and they're entertaining people who bought a ticket to see them go out there and race. If I'm a fan, I am not going to pay to go to the Daytona 500 to watch these guys run single file around the top of the racetrack for 190 laps. So I was perfectly fine with what happened. I think in some cases the blocking was a little extreme for, you know, certain points in the race. But I also think that a lot of it also had to do with just how unstable these cars were. So, you know, the situation, the crash between Keselowski and Chase Elliott at the end of stage one, I think that was a little bit I think that was a combination of a little bit too aggressive with these guys moving around in different lanes, and I think a lot of it had to do with how the air was moving and things like that. So I was highly entertained. I don't want to see these guys riding around. So I kind of forgot your original question.
I think what with you saying that kind of sparked my mind and had me going off in a direction thinking, you know, the stakes are so much higher in the gamble aspect at the super speedways at Daytona and Talladega that if you want to take a chance, it might be glory or it's 0 or 10. There is no like, oh, well, I tried this, it didn't quite work, or whatever. It's I am out of the race now, versus I got the stage points or something. And you don't really see that at the other tracks, that kind of gambling, that hard of a binary gambling aspect of it.
Well, I don't think so. With plates, it's already a gamble, right? The entire race around the track.
Sure, we talked about
it. It is a gamble. But so what I want to say is we've heard multiple drivers talk about how before we had stages, stage racing and stage points and accountability there, they would just ride for 80% of the race or even more. So whatever wrecking accompanies that stage racing component, I think we're just going to have to live with if we want these guys to race every lap.
Yeah, yeah. So
I think a really good example of what stage racing does to cup races is go back and rewatch Darlington from last year and try to convince me that if we don't have stage racing, that Kyle Larson and Martin Truex Jr. race each other as hard as they do 30 laps into a race or whatever the end of stage one was when they finished pretty much side by side at the line for that playoff point. If we don't have stage racing, I don't think we get stuff like that. You know, same thing with Martinsville. Everybody will remember, you know, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. knocking Kyle Busch out of the way to try and stay on the lead lap. If we don't have stage racing, I don't think we get moments like that. I think, again, it goes back to these guys are saving their car and, again, not that there's anything wrong with that, but too many times the saving their cars and things like that would lend itself to, you know, quote unquote boring races because there was no action in the middle of the race. So it plays out a little bit differently with restrictor plate racing because again we've wrecked at plate races for years. But I think in general, again, places like Martinsville and Darlington, you know, go back and watch those races and try and convince me that we don't have, you know, we have action like that in the middle of the race if we're not competing for stage points.
I agree with you. I was very skeptical about the stages, and we even deliberately called them segments long after NASCAR said they didn't want people to be calling them that. As non-journalists, we can get away with stuff like that. But I really do think that the stages have introduced something really good to NASCAR, especially considering that the number of phantom debris cautions has significantly been reduced. And I think it's better for the TV product. Like, look, if you're already going to try to break these races up because you have a plan, why not just announce that plan ahead of time? I think the biggest thing that NASCAR has struggled with is being transparent and saying, this is what we want to do. And this is why we want to do it. And this is why we think you're going to like it. And NASCAR fans are grumpy as a whole in general. But I don't think there's
that's a whole separate podcast, and I can get myself in complete trouble because I will start spouting off nonsense about the NASCAR fan base.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, yeah, we know that already. We know, I mean, it's not keep it between the ditches. It's not keep it between the white lines on this podcast. It's not keep it between the ditches. It's keep it between the guardrails. Because we understand that there's so many different varying opinions by the fans and what they want to see and what NASCAR is doing. Because NASCAR does a lot of weird things, right? The weirdest thing they do is not be transparent. The weirdest thing they could possibly do is have the biggest face in NASCAR not understand a significant rule in plate racing regarding the double yellow line. Now, Junior has taken ownership of that, not understanding the rule. But Odd Steve having to disseminate it over Twitter means they haven't explained it well enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
go back to last year when drivers and teams were trying to claim that they didn't understand the Jimmy Johnson rule where he pulled out of his pit box and stopped to put a lug nut on. I mean, that is a rule. That is something that NASCAR had told teams, but I guess some people either didn't pay attention or didn't get it clarified because, you know, leave it to Chad Knaus to know the rules better than everybody else.
So, yeah, always.
So we got to – let's go ahead and move on to – we've got a bunch of –
rapid fire.
Yeah, we got a bunch of questions from the PETM posse this week, so we'll rapid fire them out. Mick Rose at GoDucks42_Mick says, who's your overall sleeper to get a win in any of the three national touring series? That's – you know, if you'd have said...
And you're on the clock, Jeopardy.
Right? If you'd have said Cup, you know, I'd have had one answer if you say this or that. Here's what I'm going to say. Kaz Grala is now in Xfinity Series. He's got the win at Daytona, obviously, last year.
He's racing
for
GMS
now,
right?
He's been on the podcast. He's GMS. And he was, like, top 10, maybe 8,
yeah,
maybe
I think he got
like
or
6
or something.
Let me look it up. I'll look it up while I'm doing
that.
This.
We should have had that.
I know.
Okay.
Well, no, my point is, I think... whether or not it's at a super speedway or whatever, I'm taking Kaz Grala. He finished sixth, by the way. So
yeah,
there you
that's
go.
That's what I thought, sixth.
So
that's our Georgia Tech boy. I don't know if he's decided to actually enroll. He had planned to enroll, but then he moved up to Xfinity. And somehow racing a race car in a National Touring Series sounds better than studying mechanical engineering. So, Kelly, who do you have as your sleeper overall in the three National Touring Series? Overall, this include all the series. Who do you think nobody knows about that's probably going to win this year?
Oh, my goodness. That is putting me on the spot, and I'm trying to rack my brain. I don't know. I may have to think about that and put it out on Twitter later because I feel like everybody that, you know, we kind of know or think about or has a ride – I think we kind of expect or hope maybe to win. So if I'm going to have to dig deep and really go out on a limb, I may have to get back to you on that. I think my first inclination, and this isn't really a sleeper, maybe because of the team that he's with. And, you know, we certainly know who he is, but maybe Ryan Truex with Kolek in the Xfinity series.
There we go,
I think that
Carl.
Would be,
I like it a lot.
That would be a pretty big upset, I feel like.
I just saw Carl on the YouTube comments say Ryan Truex. I think you've got some good company there in that pick.
Well, if you think of something else, be sure and tell us.
Just because of the team, I mean, not to diminish what Kolek Racing is doing at all, but, you know, let's be honest, they're fighting against some pretty big teams. So I think that would be my first one. But I may have to go look around at some of these rosters and dig a little deeper on that one.
Well, tag the old PTM if you come up with something you think is awesome.
Sherwin?
And we'll get right to the next one from Frank Vallat.
Oh, wait, what's yours?
Oh, I have to pick one?
Yes, obviously. I mean, this
Bubba Wallace.
I love it. All right. That needs no further explanation. Frank Vallat, at Frank Vallat, he says, all right, I love this question. We've had it a couple times for the journalists and writers and stuff. What's the funniest or most awkward answer someone has given you during a press conference or interview?
And I thought this might be two questions.
It could be, but like, what's the most? How about most memorable off the wall answer you've gotten?
Man, nothing is coming to mind. I must be bad at my job.
No,
I must not be memorable or like good enough to where they're making off the wall comments or. Or awkward. I don't know.
Oh man. Well, you need some more.
Like,
you
I've
need
had,
some more
like,
people
I've
that
had,
are
like some self-serving moments. Like I can, you know,
those are fine.
Like, you know, Brad Keselowski. One of the back when I first started really covering races consistently at the racetrack. Brad Keselowski at Charlotte in 2013. When he won the fall Charlotte race, and he came into the media center, and I asked a question. So I'll say this. In terms of awkward, it was awkward for me because I asked a question, and you know, when you're in the media center, you state your name and your affiliation, which is, of course, whoever you are working for. So I said my name and my affiliation, and I was sitting in the back of the room, so I don't think he saw me, but again, you know, I say my name, my affiliation, and I start asking the question. And when I do that, I see Brad sitting on the stage, and he gets like a weird look on his face. And I got really nervous. I was like, oh boy. And like he was trying to think of something, or you know, just, you know how like somebody says something and like you just kind of stop and like you can, like, the wheels start turning. And yeah. I was like, I got so nervous. So I finished the question. I'm like bright red because I was already nervous to ask a question. I was still relatively new. And he pauses before he answers, and I'm like, oh my God, this is gonna, like, he doesn't know me, or he doesn't like me or something. And he then just turned around and goes, oh, Kelly Crandall, I've read your stuff. Nice to meet you. And then he answers the question. And I had no idea that is where that was going to go. And I was just so freaking nervous. And afterwards, when the press conference was done, like, so many people in the media center were like, that was so cool, and came over and talked to me. So that's like a self-serving moment. I've had a few of those, but I guess I'm thankfully, maybe pat myself on the back, I guess I'm pretty decent at my job, that I haven't really had too many like awkward interactions or anything like that.
Well, Sherwin, we've been like an hour and 5 minutes. Let's go ahead and gas this up and get us through the last portion here of going to Atlanta. Me and Sherwin will be there. We are looking at the weather and whatnot and trying to figure out if that's going to be an ordeal. But we'll figure it out. Sherwin, you're like, what's going on, Sherwin?
You tell me.
we're going to, let's go straight into this. So the we've got a question from the group. Well, let's start with this, Kelly. Last year, we at this point in time, we were talking with the president of Atlanta Motor Speedway, and he was telling us about what was going on with the repave and all that, and that, you know, it's a bummer for, you know, drivers and stuff, but it's definitely going to happen and blah blah blah. And you know, he does what he has to do in order to kind of sell everybody on what's going on, and then next thing we hear, it's just kind of silent, like, we're not going to repave. We're just not going to do that anymore.
They did so, kind of do that.
So what? I don't know. What's your hot take on that one?
In terms of like how that played out last year, or in terms of Atlanta being repaved in general?
What's the deal? Yeah, exactly that. Atlanta repave in general.
Yeah, I think that would is probably coming much sooner than later. It's funny, I actually have to, before this weekend, I plan on pulling out some audio from, leftover audio from the media tour where Mr. Clark was in attendance, and I think he talked about what the status of that may be. So I have to go listen to my audio, and that may be okay. A story that pops up on Racer, but don't hold me to that, because once again, I have to go review the audio. But I think it's going to happen. I would be very surprised if it doesn't happen after this race, because as much as I love Atlanta, I think the surface is fantastic. I think the racing, because of the surface, is fantastic. I just don't see how that track can hold up much longer with these heavy stock cars. You're going to have three races, practice, qualifying, like just so much going on this weekend. And with the weather, as much as I would love for Atlanta to stay the same forever, I just have a feeling this may be the last weekend we get with it.
Well, last year was supposed to have been that.
I
would be surprised if they don't.
I'm with you. I was so sad last year too, and I think I actually wrote. I think I wrote on Racer, my column after race weekend was like, please, just one more year. So I got my wish. So if it does end up being the last year, I will be thankful. But I just, again, I think just realistically, I don't know how much longer that pavement can hold up.
Well, we're definitely planning to have Ed Clark on the show in very soon. And I think I was mostly interested in having him on after they make that decision.
Right.
And just let him walk through that decision and talk to the fans, because obviously everybody loves that surface. The racers love the surface. The fans love the surface. So to listen to a fan who actually runs a track talk through why they need to do it and how they're going to do it, I think would be very valuable. So that's why we waited. We didn't want to do Ed Clark for the preview show to Atlanta, because we want to let him talk about what happens after we see that race.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think of it this way. I mean, the absolute worst thing that can happen is everybody says, don't pave it, don't pave it, don't pave it. And Atlanta says, okay, we won't touch it, which is what they did, you know, last year. But, you know, hypothetically, they can only do that for so long before we get into a situation to where we are actually racing and the surface starts to come apart. Like, and then everybody's going to criticize Atlanta for, you know, not doing what they need to do. Because, you know, look, I remember like it was yesterday when the Martinsville concrete started coming up and punched a huge hole in Jeff Gordon's nose, you know, in the middle of the race, and they had to go out there and patch up the racetrack. So that would be the worst thing that we could happen. So I hope, you know, I hope good things this weekend. And then, you know, either way, that's a tough decision for Ed Clark and everybody involved.
Yeah, well, we had that happen at Dover. We had it happen at Daytona.
Yeah, Dover. I was there for that one, too. That was some crazy-ish.
If the weather stays the way it is at Atlanta, we're going to hear it again because of how difficult it is to dry on a cold surface.
If it rains at 8 a.m., we can't race, and it stops
it'll be a
at
night
9
race.
A.m. Yeah, it would be a night race. And then if it decides to rain halfway through again, we can't do it. But if it doesn't rain at all, you know, we get another please don't repave this track. So
exactly.
It's
damned,
you know,
if you do, damned if you don't.
Yep, exactly. So let's go ahead.
It's going to be tough either way for whoever has to make that decision.
Let's go ahead. And Sherwin, we've got a new deal. We had the dude at Pocono for like the trucks race forever doing our picks sound effect.
Oh, he was awesome.
And this is no dig against him, but we've got a new sound effect, y'all. Here it is.
Somebody we all know quite well took it to heart, calling to fire.
And he didn't, like, in the interviews afterwards, he's like, I wasn't planning on being that crazy, but when you're in the moment and you get to do that, we saw a side of Junior we've never seen right there. So we're going with picks. So that brings us to another Ask PETM question. Andy and David at MOATF Podcast. What's up, fellas? They say, what does the local knowledge say about who to pick for DraftKings this week, apart from the 48, obviously? Here's the deal for me, by the way, is I last week in Daytona, I was talking about the young guns versus veterans. We've already talked about this surface and the history that this thing has. Atlanta is, in my opinion, all about the history. You've got to pick somebody who knows what's going on here. Now, here's the crazy part, is Chase Elliott has driven here since he was 13, 14 years old. Sherwin was at those races,
11.
Too. 10, 11 years old. He knows this surface. So that's a good, I'm not sure. But if I'm going to put money, I'm going to put money on somebody who's been around. And my money, my pick, is Mr. Kurt Busch.
Oh, man. I love that. One of the more adaptable race car drivers.
Right. Right, best wheelman in NASCAR.
So
right there.
Is it? Am I allowed to pick for 2 weeks in a row?
You're allowed to do whatever you want.
Yeah, well.
This year we're trying to pick the right people. Last year we kept trying to pick these people who, like, think about that, and we lost every weekend to our buddies over lap traffic. And
yeah,
so,
we
Brandon,
did.
We're trying to beat your asses this year.
I love your excitement.
I'm excited. Let's do this.
Because you're absolutely right. So in an effort to be as excited as we could possibly be, I'm picking Chase Elliott for the second week in a row.
There you go.
Hometown track, Dawsonville, Georgia. Let's ring the siren.
How huge would that be? Kelly, what's your pick?
One pick, or do you want me to just name some drivers that I think are pretty good in the lineup?
I mean, we like...
However you do it.
We like polarity here. Pick somebody and be like, this is who's going to win, and everybody else go jump in the lake.
I guess if I had to pick a race winner, I'll go with Harvick, just after how he performed there last year. But if anybody's looking for really bad fantasy advice, you know, because I'm all about giving out advice that sounds good and is not. My dad thanks me every week. I would say Harvick, Keselowski, Brad is obviously the defending winner. I'll even throw Truex in there because you know, while we Atlanta is its own animal. It's still a 1.5 mile track, and we know he dominated last year. And then, yeah, you got to throw Jimmy in there, and I'll throw Chase Elliott in there as well, because I think the Camaro is gonna do quite well. So, yeah, take that to the bank and get nothing in return.
On that note, I wanted to say this about that DraftKings stuff. If you're looking for a value pick at the mid pack to bottom level pack of what probably DraftKings is going to value these people at, number 95, Kasey Kahne.
Ooh, yes. Mm, run that.
Interesting.
Boy, that high line.
Three wins.
By the low line. And
we were there for two of them.
We got to see, because Daytona's such a – he had such a good car at Daytona, and that was –
he was in the top 10 every time that he didn't have a weird thing happen.
He was in the top
10,
and then he went through the pits at like 95 miles an hour and you know, had to be in the back. He was drafting with Denny when Denny was a lap down, and he wasn't. Then he got back into the top 10 and got collected in the Chase Elliott slash whoever.
Brad
Keselowski wreck.
Danica Patrick.
Yeah, and got collected. So this week, I think this week in a lot of ways says, okay, who's got what? Like last week was – run what you brung, you know, and you might have a chance at the end, depending on if you're in a wreck. This week is all right. Who's actually here
to race
Atlanta and knows Atlanta? I love that. I love that pick with Kasey Kahne. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm a Kasey Kahne fan, but regardless, I think
but
that
it's
is,
still a value pick for DraftKings.
Yes, absolutely.
I will say too, though, I think you make excellent points. But again, I think you also have to take it a little bit with a grain of salt, because Atlanta is a little bit of its own animal. Again, just talking about, you know, the surface and being so early in the season, you know, in terms of these teams really starting to get up to speed with their drivers and their cars and stuff. But I think you make excellent points, because when Kasey and that 95 team, when they start settling in and really getting up to speed and get going and get comfortable and really start, you know, developing their cars, I think he could be, going back to, you know, an earlier question, I think he could be a sleeper in general, because I'm not sure many people have a lot of expectations for that team. They certainly have a lot of expectations for themselves. So I think once they get going, they could really surprise some people.
Well, absolutely, and they also have that strange combination that JTG Doherty now has, which is they're going to run ECR motors, but they're going to have an Hendrick technical alliance, which is interesting to see how that'll play out.
So that brings us, dude, to Stranger Stang.
Oh, let's boy.
Here we go. There's a
Kelly, if you don't remember, this is where it really goes off the rails.
Yeah, this is where we hit the ditch.
Yeah, I remember.
She remembers. I need to look up in what our Stranger Stang questions were the last time when
I think
Kelly
it was like
on.
Episode 74.
We'll see what that is. Anyway, so this is a headline version. So there was a headline. There was a woman videotaped drying her underpants with the air vent on a packed flight. On an airplane. Yeah. So what's the most uncomfortable... the video...
the noise was funny.
Oh, Lord. What's the most uncomfortable situation you've ever been in on a plane, and what did you do to mitigate it? I'll tell you all this. There's one that just comes to mind. Me and my wife, we were headed on vacation somewhere, and there was these two kids and this, like... She had to be, like, a 19-year-old nanny that was with them. Like, it obviously wasn't their big sister. This was somebody who was like assigned
flying
to,
back to Australia.
Yeah. To be like the person that takes care of them. They were, I'm pretty passive about stuff. Like I can get over stuff. They were kicking the back of my seat. Ha ha, whatever. But I mean, they were kicking. I didn't know kids like this was like a cartoon thing, how much they were kicking.
It was like Kindergarten Cop where he does the pencil break thing.
Right. And I turn around and I go, and I look at the 19-year-old or 20-year-old caregiver lady, and I was like, are you serious right now? Like, you can't, no, this ain't right. Now, these kids were like, all right, I'm going to go way politically incorrect here. You ever seen them kids that are like, I'm going to use quote fingers, ADD, but it's because they're kind of like encouraged to be, you know, like Like, they're not really. There's people, and, like, and that's the thing.
Me at 37, if I was, like, exact same at, but, like, 7.
There's people who are, like, ADD and ADHD is a real, you know, it's a...
It is a thing.
A psychological thing. It's a cognitive disorder. It's
a
thing.
I'm not sure we should be giving them meth, but however
right,
we do it.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. But point is, I think there's also the people who are ADD because they were diagnosed that and their parent, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm going off the rails here. These were those kids, is what I'm saying.
Oh, God. Just and uncontrollable.
So, just uncontrollable.
Well,
and,
no, because they never had established rules.
They ain't never been hit by a Southern dad, is the point. You know, like, get you upside the head one time.
Amen to that.
See what happens, you know? And I corporal punishment, just, blah, blah, blah. I'm not trying to go into that. I'm just saying they ain't never been hit upside the head by a Southern
dad. They don't understand what the real consequences of misbehaving is.
Right, right. So, one of them ended up, like, barfing everywhere on...
Mexican salad.
So I got the back of my seat kicked. I turned around in like passive Rusty became aggressive and was like, "Are you serious right now?" And
I would have loved to have seen this, y'all, because I've
and
never seen it.
It smelled like hot Doritos.
Oh,
I don't know,
no.
I don't know any other way to put it than it smelled like hot Doritos on the entire plane. And I don't know how you distinguish like hot Doritos between cold ones, but if you had smelled this, you'd have been like, "That smells like hot Doritos." So that's the worst plane experience I've had, and that sticks with me. Sure.
Good grief. Mine is significantly less
dramatic.
Actually, you know what? Hold on. Actually, I just thought about this. My worst experience was my sister being sick sitting next to me.
Uh-oh.
And, like, we never, like, so this was a West Coast flight because we used to fly, like, so my dad used to work for Delta, and so we got to fly, and so we would. And my dad's from the West Coast, so we would fly. And it would be like an L-1011. So, like, we're little kids in these huge seats, and it's like, what is an L-1011? It's like 252?
Yeah, yeah. Like, they don't fly them anymore. They got the big screen TV that comes down and stuff.
Man,
yeah,
it's ridiculous.
I've been on one once.
Lydia, I mean, she got the pork and I got the chicken, and she barfed her brains out. Like, kind of in between us. I got a little on me, but not a lot. It really wasn't that bad. To focus in on what the modern day, this is not acceptable deal with flying right now is I saw a woman put her bare foot on the back of an armrest.
No.
Of the person in front of him. And I was like, this is not okay. I took a picture and I'm pretty sure I tweeted as we were taking off. That is not acceptable. So, people who are listening, you cannot put your bare foot on somebody else's seat. That's not okay. That is never going to be okay.
Oh,
yeah. If that was me, some stuff would have went down.
Yeah. So, like, I think if I'd have been like in the seat where she was doing it to, I probably wouldn't have noticed. But it was like to my left and one row up, and I'm like, oh my God, what are you? No. Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
That's not okay.
Yeah. Kelly, worst one.
Nothing is near dramatic as that. I mean, thankfully, the amount of travel that I do is all relatively close to home, so I don't fly much. But I've had a couple, like, shake my head moments, like nothing dramatic, and it takes a lot for me. Like, I don't like confrontation, so it would take a lot. It would take somebody putting their bare foot on my seat for me raise hell. But I mean, the two that come to mind in terms of like just, I guess, oh my God moments, or just again, just like awkward is I was on one flight and we were boarding, and I felt so bad. Like, I wish I could have done, like, something, because I felt so bad for this woman. She was flying with these two little kids, and just judging by what the one little girl was screaming, I'm assuming one was her actual child, and maybe the other was, like, a stepchild or something, because this little girl was screaming at the top of her lungs for, like, 30 minutes, and like nobody knew what to do, like, because it was just so awkward, because she kept screaming, like, you know, I'm not your child, I'm not your real daughter, or I'm not your real family, or whatever it was.
Lord.
And I felt so bad for for this woman, because she must have been like horrified that she could not, like, she could not calm this child down. This child was having none of it. Like, she didn't want to talk to flight attendants. She didn't want to talk to other passengers. She just kept screaming, you know, "You're not my real family," or whatever it was. And I was, like, horrified for this woman. And I wish I could have done something.
Lordy.
Well, it was, like, it was horrible. The other one was, like, I've had people, like, be in my seat. And, again, I don't like confrontation, so I kind of, like, like, I become that awkward person to where, like, I just, like, kind of stare at you, like, as if I can't believe you're, like, real. Like I can see you, but I don't know, like my mouth doesn't work, so I just stare, like, awkwardly. So I've had that happen where I had that happen, I think, on one of my most – I think on one flight last year, I was going, I forget what race I was going to, and I boarded, and this group of people just decided that they were going to, none of them want, like, they were all split up, so none of them wanted to sit in their assigned seats. So they just decided they were going to sit together, and they took, like, a whole bunch of people's spots. So again, I'm not confrontational, so I got to the row and kind of just, like, stared, like, okay, like, I can see you, type thing. Like, yeah, it's,
your number,
I'm not doing,
and your letter doesn't,
but,
say,
again, if your bare foot is on my seat, then I will get confrontational.
Right.
Oh, that's not good at all.
Kelly, with that bombshell, close us out. Tell us where people can find you. Tell us what's going on, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Well, if I haven't scared anybody off, Twitter, Facebook, that's where all of my racing exploits will be. Of course, I can plug the podcast now, the Racing Writers Podcast. Yeah. Just don't give me a 1-star. I've already done that to myself, which is, you know, just a funny story. I don't think
that.
You guys want to hear that, but, yeah, so the Racing Writers Podcast is on iTunes and SoundCloud. Facebook, I have a public page for where just all my writing is, so I try to get people to go to that. I think it's just my name, to be honest with you. And then, yeah, so Twitter. I have Instagram if anybody wants to follow me on there, but it's not really racing related, so you're more likely to see pictures of my dog and wrestling belts. I don't know.
Wrestling belts. I love it.
I've seen them.
All right, Sherwin, it's time for us to close this thing out.
I can't wait to see it at Atlanta, hopefully.
Yeah, that'll be awesome. Thank you, Kelly, for being on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that, y'all know where to find us. It's PTM Podcast at PTM Podcast on the Twitter, and PTM Podcast everywhere that you can search, everywhere that you can look. Find us under every nook, every cranny. You know where to go. And I'm Tailgate Mayor at Tailgate Mayor, Russell Wallace.
And I am Pregame Engineer Andrew Sherwin at Pregame Engineer at Andrew L. Sherwin on the Instagram. Like Rusty said, all you got to do is Google PTM Racing Podcast. You'll find any possible outlet you might want to listen to our show on.
All right, and we'll talk to y'all very soon at Atlanta, and we'll talk to Kelly at Atlanta. It's going to be awesome. Can't wait to see y'all there.
Hell, we'll probably be doing another show down there, so y'all just hold tight.
We'll see what happens.
It's running on fear.